Welcome to the New Life Podcast, a ministry of New Life Presbyterian Church in Ithaca, New York. Join us for worship each week at 10 o'clock at 950 Danby Road, Ithaca, New York. You can also visit us on our website, www.newlifeithaca.org.
This is the third lesson in Theo 100, what we're calling Theo 100, which is an introduction to theology. And we already had two lessons. The first lesson was on what is theology and why should we do it? What's the importance of it? Try to make it an apologetic for everyone learning theology. The basic definition was it's culturally relevant questions about God, as long as we have questions about life, existence, meaning, right and wrong, we can do theology, and we should be doing it. The second lesson was on the Bible, how the Bible's put together, the history of the Bible, the reliability of the Bible as a text. Then I had a bonus episode, which I just recorded, so if you haven't heard that, on the Apocrypha. So if you're curious about the Apocrypha, you can go listen to that. Today we're going to be talking about something called first principles. And first principles are, well, it's a philosophical term, but it's essentially the foundations of what we believe in. Where do we start is the question. Where do we start with theology? Where do we start with belief? That is essentially what I want to talk about today. I'm going to cover some philosophers and what they've said, because basically what we're trying to do is build this from the ground up. You could start theology with the Bible. In fact, I'm going to come to a quotation from the Westminster Confession of Faith, the very first chapter, which starts with the Bible. But I think in our culture, it starts with belief in God and then moves to the Bible. I think in our culture, belief in God and the Bible as an authoritative text, we can't take that for granted, right? And I think as we wrestle with these ideas ourselves as believers in this modern world, we also have doubts and questions about that. So we're not going to start where theology typically starts, with God exists and he has a Bible and we should learn from it. We're going to start with a more basic idea. And the idea is, what are the building blocks for our knowledge? What are building blocks for any knowledge? So I want to start with Aristotle. A lot of discourses on philosophy will start with Aristotle. But Aristotle was wrestling with these very same questions, even though he lived, 300-400 years before Christ. Aristotle said, there's a couple different texts that we're going to look at. One is Metaphysics, and the other is the Nicomachean Ethics. But it talks about how we know things. It said, all men naturally desire knowledge. An indication of this is our esteem for the senses. For apart from their use, we esteem them for our own sake. And most of all, the sense of sight. So he's talking about how we know things, and he's saying vision is the main way we know things. Not only with a view to action, but even when no action is contemplated, we prefer sight, generally speaking, to all the other senses. The reason of this is that of all the senses, sight best helps us to know things and reveals many distinctions. Essentially, what distinguished Aristotle from his mentor Plato was that Aristotle wants to make room for our senses being a reliable source of knowledge. We're going to see later with Descartes. Descartes thought we could be deceived by our senses, and that was essentially what Plato had said, that we can't trust our senses. Well, the reason why the scientific revolution blossomed when it did was because the West rediscovered Aristotle, mediated through Arabic scholars, actually. And Aristotelian philosophy gives us the ability to pursue scientific knowledge because it says that we can get reliable information about our world from our senses. So here's what he says about science. Experience seems very similar to science and art, but actually it is through experience that men acquire science and art. For as Polus rightly says, experience produces art, but inexperience chance. So the principle here is that we see things and we experience things and we build knowledge. He says that's science and art. Now, art can be fine art like painting, but I think art refers more to what we call the liberal arts, the art of knowing, you might say, the art of discovering. He then says in his Ethics, scientific knowledge is therefore the quality whereby we demonstrate that a person, this is not my translation, a person knows a thing scientifically when he possesses a conviction arrived in a certain way, and when the first principles on which that conviction rests are known to him with certainty. So I think this is where we have to go. We have to go to a place where we are certain and build from there. I don't think it helps us very much at all to build our theology from a place where we're not certain. And so that's what Aristotle says. The first principles are convictions that we are certain about. He says, for unless he is more certain of his first principles than of the conclusion drawn from them, he will only possess knowledge in question accidentally, like a broken clock is right twice a day kind of thing. So we have to build our knowledge on certainties. We have to tear it down to that, essentially. For those of us, you know, for those of us who think this way, who are doubting or questioning, or interacting with those who do. So this is how we'll conclude with Aristotle. From going back to metaphysics, we do not consider any of the senses to be wisdom. Now, this is a key part. Scientific knowledge is indeed our chief source of knowledge, senses about particulars, but they do not tell us the reason for anything, as for example, why fire is hot, only that it's hot. I think that's a very important observation by Aristotle, is that science can tell us what, but it cannot give us the why. That's wisdom. And, of course, the pursuit of wisdom is philosophy. So, Aristotle tells us that we can use our senses and our experience to build a knowledge base, but we have to start from first principles, which are the things that we are certain about. Okay? All right, let's move to Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant was we skipped a lot ahead, but the Enlightenment is when people really started to work with doubt and knowing a lot. So that's why we skipped ahead. Immanuel Kant, in his Critique of Pure Reason, which was written in 1781, he said, "All our knowledge begins with experience. There can be no doubt. For how is it possible that the faculty of cognition should be awakened into exercise otherwise than by means of objects which affect our senses and partly of themselves produce representations, partly arouse our powers of understanding into activity to compare, to connect, to separate, and to convert the raw material of our sensuous impressions into a knowledge of objects, which is called experience." Now that's a long sentence. But what he's saying is that knowledge has to come through the observation of things. That's science, right? Scientific method is observation, making hypotheses and testing them. And this is the basis for the scientific revolution, was in the thought of people like Immanuel Kant. He said, "In respect of time, therefore, no knowledge of ours is antecedent to experience, but begins with it." Now, Kant separates the knowledge of the divine from rational knowledge. But he's pretty critical here of our knowledge base. So he says, "In whatsoever mode or by whatsoever means our knowledge may relate to objects, it is at least quite clear that the only manner in which it immediately relates to them is by means of intuition." We intuit things. We deduce things. "To this as the indispensable groundwork, all thought points to intuition gained from experience through observation of objects. But an intuition can take place only insofar as the object is given to us. This again is only possible to humans, at least on condition that the object affect the mind in a certain manner." So, similar to Aristotle, but really more materialistic. Doesn't really mention the divine or the existence of things outside of our senses. So that's where Kant lies. So how do we build on our first principles? It has to come through observation. essentially. What do we observe? What can we know? Then we go to our favorite guy, Descartes. René Descartes. We're actually going backwards in time. The reason is because I think Descartes kind of lands us in a place where we want to go. Descartes is famous for the phrase, "I think, therefore I am." We've heard that. Descartes begins with doubt. In his Meditations on First Philosophy, Descartes begins with great doubt. Descartes was essentially the first person to deconstruct. This is what this paragraph says. "It is now some years since I detected how many were the false beliefs that I had from my earliest youth admitted as true, and how doubtful was everything I had since constructed on this basis. And from that time, I was convinced that I must once for all seriously undertake to rid myself of all the opinions in which I had formerly accepted and to commence to build anew the foundation if I wanted to establish any firm and permanent structure in the sciences." So he deconstructed all the way to the studs, and he's going to build it back. Some of us have done that in our life. Some of us have friends that have done that as well. Descartes was, I guess, the first millennial because he deconstructed before it was cool. So what he did first was wrestle with doubt and doubt of his own existence. So Descartes really goes down to the studs, really down to the foundation. He's wrestling with whether he can know that he exists. And I think I'm going to... He talks about how we can know things. We should cover this. It's similar to what Aristotle said. In fact, at times he looks a little more Platonic. Let me just read this to you. "All that up to the present time I have accepted as most true and certain I have learned either from the senses..." So it sounds like Aristotle, sounds like Kant. "But it is sometimes proved to me that these senses are deceptive." That sounds like Plato. We can be deceived by our senses. He says it is wiser not to trust anything by which we have once been deceived. "But it may be that although the senses sometimes deceive us concerning things which are hardly perceptible or very far away..." So I think this is a key phrase by Descartes. He's admitting that it's hard to know things that are very far away or hardly perceptible. So for me, that's the entryway. You know, how do we know things that are very far away or hard to perceive? Just keep a pin in that. He says, "There are many others to be met with as to which we cannot reasonably have any doubt, although we recognize them by their means." So in other words, similar to what Aristotle had said, I can be sure that this pulpit, this podium, is hard by knocking it. Pretty certain it's hard, right? I can be certain that it's brown, you know, that it is probably the most unique pulpit of anything anybody's ever seen. Most visiting pastors will say something like that. That's a very unique pulpit. I can observe these things and know these things. But the origins of the universe, that's harder for me to know, especially things that are far off. So this is where he moves into the doubt of his very self. As he's deconstructing this down to the studs, he says, "What of thinking? I find here that thought is an attribute that belongs to me." So he's wondering if he could even, how can he know that he even exists? What if I'm in a dream? How can I know that this is real? Like anything around me is real. How can I really know that? So he's really wrestling with the fundamentals here. And where he lands is this famous phrase, "I'm a thinking thing. That's how I know that I exist. I think," this later in his text actually, "but I think, therefore I am." He says, "I find here that thought is an attribute that belongs to me. It alone cannot be separated from me. I am, I exist, that is certain." Down to the bottom, "I have answered. What am I? I am a thing that thinks." Now, we are more than a thing that thinks, but for Descartes, that is how we know we can exist. For him, that's the first principle. "I think, therefore I am." So, to review, what are first principles according to our review of philosophy? It took about 15 minutes. The things we can know for certain, that we exist. If we can't know that for certain, then what's the point? Right? There is no point. If we can't be sure that we exist, then none of this matters. We can do whatever we want. If this is a dream, it doesn't matter, right? So we have to start there, that we exist. And Descartes said, we can know we exist because we think. The second thing we can know for certain are things we can sense. This is where we're building on Aristotle, Kant, and Descartes as well. But even the senses, and especially our interpretation of our senses, can deceive. That's Plato, Aristotle, Descartes. Descartes points out that mathematics is the only science that is indubitable. Sorry for those who aren't mathematicians. He talks about how other sciences are debatable and they can be wrong. We know that's true. Like, you know, those of you who are in sciences know that sometimes scientists are wrong about their observations and hypotheses. I think that's the point he's getting to. But pure math, you know, you probably heard mathematicians talk this way. Pure math is the only indubitable kind of science. Mathematics aside, what we can sense is what we can know, essentially. Unless it's far off or hard to perceive. You know, Schrodinger's cat, for example. Thirdly, what we can intuit with our senses from experience. So this is where science is. We can learn, we can experiment, we can observe, we can build a knowledge base. On the board is some mathematical proof being proven out. I don't know what it is. I didn't take time to look at it, actually, but some sort of proof. This is what most of you do, is you work with the raw material of the universe. You make observations. You build on past knowledge. You test a hypothesis. You try to prove it. You try to increase our knowledge base. And you try to make our world better. That's what scientists are doing, most scientists. Anyway, so that's a first principle, is we can intuit from our experience the things that are. We can learn. And the fourth thing is that this is not wisdom, though. All science can do is explain the what. It cannot explain the why. So, the next question. Is God a first principle? Is God a first principle? Can we assume the existence of God? Well, yes and no, I think. Presuppositionalism is a branch of Christian apologetics. That's a lot of big words. Apologetics is the discipline of defending the faith. So there is a line of thought that says that we should presuppose that God exists and then work from there. And that's what many Christians do. We presuppose that God exists and we work from there. That's an easy start. But that's not good enough for me, and I think that's not good enough for a lot of people. Yes, I do believe God exists, but I want to work with something a little more firmer, I think, than just presupposition, especially when I'm struggling with doubt and when I'm trying to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know if they believe in God or not. It's a legitimate question that people have, and I've had those conversations. This is not often enough, as I just said, for those struggling with doubt or those who are committed atheists. You can't just say, presuppose God exists and work from there to someone who's doubting or someone who's an atheist, because they don't believe that. So, in Meditations on First Philosophy, Descartes moves from knowledge of his personal existence directly to the existence of God. That's the point of it. Descartes' Meditations on First Philosophy was to prove God exists. And the way he does it is through a synthesis of Aristotle's argument from the unmoved mover, we'll talk about that in a minute, and Anselm's ontological argument from the Proslogion. Now, actually, if you're not familiar with the ontological argument, it basically says that we know God exists because I can conceive that God exists. It's much more than that, and he goes through many steps, but that's the ontological argument. If I can conceive of an infinite being that's all powerful and all good, unless that being exists, that conception is, well, it's not true. That'll be certain. So the ontological argument, I mean, it's good as far as it goes, but Descartes synthesizes it with Aristotle's ontological argument, which I think is much better for an argument for God, and I'll go through that in a second. So from science, we can observe that everything has a cause. right? This is part of a fundamental scientific belief. You know, an object at rest remains at rest unless it's acted upon, right? Every motion has a cause. Are you tracking with me? You agree? Okay. I'm in a room of scientists. I got to watch myself. Everything has a cause. Do we know that for certain? Everything has a cause? Do we know that for certain? Shaking your head? You trying to think of... Yeah, you can't prove a negative, right? Well, just we'll build with that. Everything has a cause, okay? And we can trace those causes back to an event called the Big Bang. So, this begs the question, though, what caused the Big Bang? And we talked about in the sermon, I think that's what's nagging Al Pacino in this interview in the New York Times that I mentioned. What caused it? What is it? Something made this, he keeps saying. Something made this. He's wrestling with that. Well, there's a couple of theories about what caused the Big Bang. And maybe there's some others that you've heard, and I'd be happy to, you know, you can tell me what they are, what you've heard, or how you've worked through it. But one of them is it has no cause. This is what we call infinite regress. You know, something caused it and something caused that, and it just continues in infinitude. In other words, the universe does not have a beginning. Just something caused the Big Bang. Before the Big Bang, there was some other event that caused all matter in the universe to constrict, and then boom, right? So there may not be a cause. The universe may not have a beginning, or the universe, space-time may be circular. I've heard this before. I can't fathom what it means. But space-time may be circular. It travels in loops. And basically, you got caught up in a loop that caused the Big Bang. But to me, I don't know. If you go in the loop, you're still linear. And something had to cause it. I'm not sure if that solves the problem. Do you understand what I'm saying? This sort of idea of time not being linear. And that's how the Big Bang could have started. Because of a loop in time went back and caused it. You know, like Doctor Who going in the TARDIS sort of thing. Maybe Doctor Who started the Big Bang. Yeah, it would be. Or there's a first cause. And this is Aristotle's argument from causation. There is a first cause that is uncaused. And that first cause, he called, well, it could be two things. It could be God. No, that's where we may land. Or it could be some other cause. So one of the theories is that something from another universe came in and caused it. You know, this multi-universe theory, multiple worlds theory, this is what I think a lot of people do to explain life and existence in our universe, is this sort of multiple worlds theory. At least I've heard it discussed with me as I've talked with people about belief and where does this stuff come from? One of the ideas is that someone else from another universe or something from another universe started it. So there's some other cause, or the cause is God. Now, I like applying Occam's razor whenever things get hairy. Thank you. So for me, personally, the simpler answer is that something caused it. Now, that doesn't work for everybody, I understand. We've got to wrestle through these ourselves, but Of the options, something caused it. It was interesting in that the interview that I quoted, Al Pacino obviously thinks something caused it. I think it's a reasonable thing to infer or intuit that something caused it. So let's explore that. God as the unmoved mover. Okay? It makes the most sense, and it's the simplest answer, I think, that the universe would have a beginning. Now, if that beginning... Well, I'll get there. I'm going to get ahead of myself. It also makes sense that a very powerful being would be the first cause. Something or someone that started things up had to be powerful enough to create all that stuff, put it into a very small space, and let it erupt. And apparently... orchestrate. Now, we'll get to Thomas Aquinas' arguments in a minute. But I think orchestrating the fallout of the universe so that it perfectly laid out to be what it is, that's another aspect here. Now, of course, if you believe in infinite universes, we just happen to be in the one that worked out, or one of the ones that worked out. It was pointed out to me, not the only one, but one of the ones. That makes us very lucky, very, very lucky. So good for us. But a being that started things, a being that moved the first cause, that moved the chain of events, it makes sense that this is a very powerful being that would be the first cause. And I would point out that even if you believe in other universes, you still need a beginning. Like, one of those universes had to have a beginning. Seems rational to me that the beginning had to start somewhere. In order to truly be a first cause, this being or entity would have to be eternal, exist outside of time, having no beginning. Now, this is the hard part for people to grasp, and indeed it's hard for me. How is it that God doesn't have a beginning? What caused God? And then you get your mind in loops trying to think through that. You know, kind of have your little existential crisis if you're not careful. But if we struggle with the idea of God having no beginning, the universe has the same problem, right? So if we don't think that God existed, powerful, outside of time, and created all things, okay, I can't conceive of God not having been created. Well, now we're back to the universe not having a beginning. Like, we have the same problem. And so if we have both problems, either the universe didn't have a start or God didn't have a start, you know, either we worship the universe as an eternal self-existent reality or we worship God as an eternal self-existent reality. It's really kind of the choices. So there's a choice there. And some people choose the universe, right? Some people say, that's where I am. I believe in the universe, whatever that means. That's going to be where I land. I still don't think you have solved the problem of first cause, but if you believe in eternality, then that's what you follow. You guys tracking with me? We're building up from the very beginning, and we're trying to build up to what caused it. The cause is God. Or not. There's a parting of the ways right there. But so far for me, I'm building on things that I find pretty certain. There was a beginning, something caused it. Rationally, that cause had to be a powerful being. We call that God. Okay? That's where we are. Let's go to Aquinas. We're going backward in time from Descartes. See, time's not linear. I'm looping around. Aquinas had 5 arguments for God. I think the first 3 are better. Most philosophers would say that. I'll mention the last 2, but the first 3 are what we call the cosmological set of arguments, what I've been talking about, the origins of the universe. There's an argument of motion, causation, and contingency. These 3 are essentially the same argument that we've just been mentioning of the unmoved mover. So every motion had to have something that caused the motion because, well, he didn't have the laws of motion, but essentially that's what the argument is. So if something had to cause the motion, there's a first mover. Otherwise, we're in infinite regress. We have an eternal universe, so there had to be a first mover. That's the unmoved mover. I have an argument from causation. Every action has a cause. There had to be a first cause. An argument from contingency. So these 3 are, you know, they're the same, really, just different sides of the same coin. Then we get to the 4th one, which is an argument from goodness and beauty. So if you've ever read Plato or read any of Plato's disciples, Plato, the essence of Platonic philosophy is the argument for the existence of God from beauty. It's interesting. Beauty and goodness. The fact that these things exist point us to the existence of the one, is what the Greeks called it. Tahin. The unmoved mover is what they called the one. And Plato and Aristotle both got there from their thinking about the world and the universe. But Aquinas says the existence of beauty must mean that there is a source of beauty and goodness. So he postulates that this God has to be beautiful, this God has to be good, and on top of being powerful and eternal. He also adds the argument from governance. And I think This is the one that we call the fine tuning, the fact that the universe is a fine tuned, according to physical science, various constants of gravity, strong and weak nuclear forces. If they were off by small amounts, very small amounts, we wouldn't be able to exist. We have to also go back to the fact that life exists, that we exist, we're complex organisms. We're asked to believe this all happened by chance. If we don't believe in a creator that governs, that moves things. So these things don't in themselves prove God exists. I don't think you can prove God exists. Remember, we just parted ways there between the universe and God. But for me, this is one of the more powerful certainties in my life, is that I think this universe didn't happen by chance. I'm pretty certain about that. And I think that that's what draws people into faith, is they look at the world around us, look at the human body and its intricacies, the fact that life itself existed, and we think, how could that happen by chance? Even if there were infinite universes, we're in the one where it happened correctly. How many ones happened where it didn't happen correctly? How much suffering is in those universes? These really don't solve philosophical problems. They actually bring up more. So I think that the fact, looking at the world we live in and the universe that we live in, where we can look at Aurora Borealis. Did you guys see the aurora? It's amazing. Up on South Hill, it's just like I went outside. It was like a show for 4 or 5 hours. I mean, I look at that and think, I don't think this happened by chance. I really don't. So that's Aquinas' argument from governance, okay? So the God of the... So this is where we build on that, okay? The fact that there is an unmoved mover, this unmoved mover is powerful, most beautiful, source of truth, actively governing the world we live in. So we build on that to say that the God of the Bible is the unmoved mover. And, of course, we don't jump to that. We get to that. So the next step is, if God is the unmoved mover, the only way to truly know God is if God reveals God's self to us. This was the problem the Greeks had. They couldn't know God. The one that created all things, the unmoved mover, was so far separated and transcended from humanity that we could never know that God. Could never know that entity. Unknowable, And so the point of philosophy is to contemplate the one. But how do you gain knowledge of the infinite? How do you gain knowledge of this powerful being? That being would have to reveal itself, himself, herself to us. That's the basic principle of Christian theology, is that the God who is the unmoved mover, who created everything that we see, revealed God's self to us. I use a neutral term because without revelation, we don't have a name for God or a pronoun for God, right? And so the principle, the foundational principle of Christian theology is that God did reveal himself. There I went and said it. God did reveal God's self to God's creation, and he did it. That revelation is recorded in the Christian Bible. That is our claim. So Aristotle says that science can't produce the why. Descartes points out that there are things that we can't know, right? Things that are far away, things that are hard to perceive. Kant says that we can't know what the first cause is because it is outside of our experience. Therefore, God would have to reveal the true nature of God to us if we were to have any knowledge of God. We can't know God unless God reveals God's self to us. So, the Bible itself claims that it is that revelation. And I've said this before. I said this last fall in our sermon series, but we talked about this morning. C.S. Lewis said about Jesus Christ that he either is who he claimed he is, Lord, or he's lying, he's a liar, or he's, a deranged megalomaniac was the term I said. He's a lunatic. Same can be said for the Bible. The Bible makes this claim that it is the revelation of this unmoved mover to humanity. And so either that's true. Now, it doesn't have to be completely true. We're not going to go there today, but it does not presuppose that it wouldn't be errors in the revelation and transmission. We talked about that last week. So go back and review. But if the God of the Bible revealed the claim of Christianity is the claim of the Bible itself is that it is the revelation of the Creator. It is the revelation of the unmoved mover. And therefore we can know that God through that revelation. The Bible. This is where the Westminster Confession of Faith begins. They didn't talk about Descartes. Well, they kind of do. Let's look at this. I know it's small print, but maybe some of you with really good eyesight can see it. This is how our confession of faith starts. Although the light of nature, okay, that one little phrase sums up Aristotle, Kant, Aquinas, Descartes, and all the others, Isaac Newton, all the scientists. Although the light of nature and the works of creation and providence do so far manifest the goodness, wisdom, and power of God as to leave men, people, human beings, inexcusable, yet they are not sufficient to give that knowledge of God and of his will, which is necessary unto salvation. So far, we agree with Kant, we agree with Descartes, we agree with Aristotle. Right? That's exactly what they were saying. We can learn things through the light of nature. We can't learn things that are hard to perceive. The only way we can know that is, there's no way to know that God fully. Of course, it introduces the concept of salvation. They are not sufficient to give that knowledge of God and of his will, which is necessary unto salvation. These things are not sufficient for that. Therefore, it pleased the Lord in sundry times and in diverse manners to reveal himself, and the Bible does reveal God as a him, and declare that his will unto his church, and afterwards for the better preserving and propagating of the truth and for the more sure establishment and comfort of the church against the corruption of the flesh and the malice of Satan and the world to commit the same wholly unto writing, which maketh the Holy Scripture to be most necessary, those former ways of God's revealing his will unto his people being now ceased. And then it quotes the books of the Bible. Okay? So most theology begins with that. God exists, the Bible is God's revelation. We went back a little bit further in order to explore the questions that move our doubts. But ultimately we arrive at the fact that this is the central claim of Christianity. The God of the Bible is the unmoved mover. That's not something that I can, that's not a first principle. That to me is an article of faith. You believe in that based on the other things I was talking about, but it does take faith to believe that. So, to review the lesson, these are our first principles. I exist. I can intuit with my senses from experience that the universe has a beginning. That beginning needs a cause. That cause needs to be eternal, powerful, good, and true. We cannot know this first cause without it revealing itself to us. The Bible's claim is that the Bible itself is the revelation of this causer to us that we can know God. So, those are our first principles. I hope this makes sense to you as a way to kind of build up to the Bible instead of just starting with the Bible and assume that it's true, assume that we believe it. We can establish these first principles, and then we're faced with the claim that we have to accept by faith, and then we move forward. Yep.
Is this first principle that the cause is good, is that for faith, or is that?
That's a great question. I think it was something that was posited by Aristotle and Plato, that because we see truth and beauty in the world, there must be a cause of that. Where did it come from? And so the unmoved mover must be the source of truth and beauty. Now, there is an element that's purely philosophical. There is an element of faith to that, because of course, what evolutionary science would say is that these things evolved, these concepts evolved through natural selection, evolution, processes of time. We still can't explain, though, how completely self-disinterested goodness came about. That may be you picking up where I'm going? Okay. So, but yeah, that claim does require an element of faith. But we do see pagan philosophers going there, is my point. It's not just Christians who have gone there.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Please rate and review us on your podcast service and share with anyone who may be interested. The intro and outro music for the New Life podcast is provided by Sandra McCracken with her permission. Please visit her website at sandramccracken.com. We'll see you next week.